I'll just say hi. Welcome, everybody. Boker Tov. Hope everybody's doing well and healthy. We're kicking off the week. I think we have at least 9 shiurim this week. Perhaps we're looking to add one for Yom HaTzma'ut, an extra one. So it's really Rabbi Liebtag, always a pleasure to have him. He's going to give a 2-minute summary of last week's class, then we'll go straight into this week's class, the second part of a 3-part series. This evening, Mark Shapiro, the second part of the Escape to Shanghai. We invite everybody. That's at 8:30 this evening. And I'll just put in Rabbi Liebtag request if you can, and you're okay with that. If everybody wants to turn on their screen, their video, it does make it much more a community. And I can tell you it's much easier as a teacher to teach when you can see the people. But like I say, it's not a requirement, just a nice request if you can do it. Okay, Rabbi Vakasha, take it over.
Hey, thank you, Rabbi Kelman. This is shir number 2 of the 3-part series on Sefirat HaOmer. Our first class discussed the word Omer and the 3 unique times it's found in Chumash, in the story of the manna, that was chapter 16 in Sefer Shmos, in the commandment of Sefirat HaOmer in the Moadim, in the Jewish holidays in Vayikra chapter 23, and in the law about leaving over in your harvest for the poor people and being sensitive to the needs of others when you harvest your grain in the book of Devarim, in a whole set of laws about social justice. And that was in Devarim chapter 24. And the word Omer is unique to those 3 times. It's a word rarely found anywhere else in the Torah. And when I tried to explain, the Omer is first presented as a utensil and relates uniquely to the manna experience. And the manna experience was preparation for receiving the Torah. Leman anaseno haydech b'torah te'imno. And the whole idea of manna in general was to recognize that God provides us with food, and his preparation for life is going to come not only for receiving the Torah, but life in the land of Israel. And if the Torah uses the word Omer specifically with the manna, and in a strange manner calls the sacrifice that we bring or present to God in the beginning of our harvest season in the land of Israel, and we call that sacrifice Omer, and that's a unique word, then bringing the Omer must be making a thematic connection between our grain harvest in the land of Israel and the manna we received in the desert. And the statement that we're making when we bring the Omer in the land of Israel during the exact 7 weeks that coincide with our grain harvest in the land of Israel, we're making a statement that even though we're working the land and working with nature and doing everything on our own, we're making a statement that despite all that, we're considering our grain and our grain harvest as though it's manna. And even though we're working with nature, we're treating it as though it's a miracle or a gift from God. And later, because God took care of us in the desert and gave us food, once we have the land of Israel and we can be godly and we're prosperous, Chumash is, you're going to use the word Omer in a special manner that when we're wealthy and we can take care of those who don't have food, just like God took care of us in the desert and gave us manna, when we're wealthy, we can take care of those who don't have food, like in the story of Megillat Rut, where we find the word Omer again, pretty much the only time in Nevi'im. And that's going to be the special use of the word Omer in Tanakh. So that was the word Omer. That was the focus of the first year and how the Torah uses that word in a very special way to convey its message. Now, today's year is going to focus on the number 7. And the number 7 in Sefirat Omer, for sure, is very central because the number 7 is the whole idea of a week. And we're going to celebrate the holiday of weeks. That'll be the topic of next year. The actual holiday of Shavuot will be next week's topic. Today, I want to dedicate to the number 7 in Chumash. Our main focus will be studying Perek Aleph and Breishit, where the number 7 is presented. But beforehand, I want to note something, which I think is interesting. I'll share my screen. And here's our outline for today. It's called From Creation to Civilization and the number 7. Okay. The number 7 in Chumash, for sure, we find in the story of creation. For some reason, we find it in the flood. If you might remember, the flood, God tells us in Parshat Noach, in 7 days' time, God tells Noach, I'm going to bring rain for 40 days and 40 nights. Ki lamim od shiva, ani mamtir. I'm going to bring, in 7 days' time, I'm going to bring water for 40 days and 40 nights. Also in the story of the flood, from the Beimot Torah, we take 7 by 7, even though the regular animals are 2 by 2. For some reason, the kosher animals are 7 by 7. Again, why specifically 7? There's no rhyme or reason. And when you read the story the first time around, until you see a larger picture coming in Chumash later on. It's interesting, later in Sefer Bereishit, the Brit Milah is in the 8th day, which is for some reason connected to 7 plus 1. We'll probably talk about that next week a little more. I'll share about Shavuot. When we have 7 weeks, and the day after the 7 weeks, the 50th day, will be Atzeret. For some reason, we have seven lambs in the covenant between Avram and Avimelech, which might be connected, might not be connected. What's interesting, in the story of Yaakov and Lavan, we have Yaakov works for 7 years. It could be just by chance, but it's interesting that we have 7 years of work with Yaakov and Lavan. But we never find in Sefer Bereshit the concept of a week. I'm saying that with one small reservation. Why? Because Yaakov, when he's tricked and gets Leah instead of Rachel, they make another agreement, and Lavan tells him, Malei Shavua Zot, and I'll give you also Rachel. Now, there's a machloket of Parshanim. What does Lavan mean when he says Malei Shavua Zot? Does he mean keep another oath to work for 7 years, or keep another week? We celebrate for 1 week with Leah. It's a great machloket Parshanim. We usually understand it as another week because we have Sheva Brachas for a week. But you have to remember in Sefer Bereshit, the people living in Sefer Bereshit, there's no concept of Shabbat yet. There's no 7 day week because there's no rhyme or reason for a 7 day week. There's a logic for a 30 day or 29 day month because of the moon. There's a logic for a year, 365 day year, the cycle of the year. There's logic for a 24 hour day, but there's no natural logic. There's no natural cycle in nature that relates to 7 days. And that's going to be one of the special reasons why the story of creation will be special. Pharaoh's dream, for some reason, is with seven cows, and in Yosef's interpretation, it'll be 7 years. So there's something Yosef knows, probably relating to Yaakov working with Lavan for 7 years. It helps him interpret Pharaoh's dream. But later we'll see maybe why are 7 years so central to Pharaoh's dream as well. And that's all there is in Bereshit. But again, we don't find the concept of a week, of people keeping a week anytime in Sefer Bereshit. Of course, in the Midrash, our forefathers got Shabbat, but that's much more Midrashic. The most interesting time we have seven is in Sefer Shemot, when we're coming out of Egypt in Parsha V'Chodesh, and we're told to bring Korban Pesach. And then we're told, after we bring Korban Pesach, when we come to the land of Israel, celebrate Chag HaMatzot for 7 days. And there's no logical reason why 7 day celebration. I understand Korban Pesach once a year, but why are we celebrating 7 days of Chag HaMatzot? Why not 4 days, 5 days, 1 day, a month? Why 7 days of Chag HaMatzot? Now, we have a tradition that on the seventh day was Kriyat Yam Suf, but it doesn't say that anywhere in Chumash. Rashi will bring that down. But there's no rhyme or reason in the beginning, no logical reason why Chag HaMatzot would be 7 days. But for some reason it is. And that's in chapter 12 and in chapter 13. Now, in the story of the manna, that was last week's share, is the first time we have the concept of a week. Again, we have to talk about why there's a week in the story of the manna. And our first experience as a Jewish people with a week was exactly the manna experience. And we're going to return to that at the end of today's share and for sure next week. In chapter 23 in Vayikra, we have the holidays in Amor, where 7 days, the idea of seven is very central. We have 7 days of Chag HaMatzot, then we have 7 weeks of Sefirat Omer, and then we have the seventh month with a holiday on the first day, on the 10th day, and on the 15th day, we have another 7 day holiday of Chag HaSukkot. And again, no logical reason for 7 days of Chag HaSukkot other than the number seven. And also, and then in Devarim in chapter 16, we have the Shosh Regalim. We have, again, keeping Pesach in the first month. Then we have eating matzah for 7 days with the Korban Pesach, then counting 7 weeks, and then keeping Sukkot for 7 days. Again, every time we have the Shosh Regalim, the number seven is central. Hopefully we'll get to that either at the end of today's year or for sure by next week. So all I'm showing you is that in the story of creation, in Chumash itself, the number seven comes up several times in Sefer Bereshit, but not in relation to the idea of a week other than the story of creation itself. And we find laws that relate to seven before we get the concept of the week. The first concept of the week is in the story of manna that begins our whole weekly cycle. Now we're going to get to work. I'm going to take about 15, 20 minutes, and I'm going to share a different screen now. And we're going to study the story of creation. And I want to suggest the reason of what the number seven is teaching us. I think I mentioned this last week because I get in trouble for this. I want to make, which might appear to be a bold claim, I want to claim that when Chumash tells us the story of creation, the goal of Chumash is not to tell us what happened, but it's coming to tell us the purpose of creation, or how we're supposed to understand creation. Meaning, let's say you accept the scientific approach, and you're convinced that creation happened over millions and maybe billions of years, and there's no historicity to the story of creation the way it's presented. I'm not saying it's not true, but assuming the Torah is from God, of course, that's our basic assumption, and God gave us the Torah, the question is, why does God give us the story of creation? Is he coming to tell us, does God want to tell us at Matan Torah how he created? Or is God trying to explain to the Jewish people why we keep Shabbat and what's the meaning of Shabbat? Again, we're not doubting the Torah being from God. We're not doubting the truth of prophecy, of Nevuah. The question is, when you study Torah, do you have to take it literally? Or is it permitted? Is it possible to take it seriously and not necessarily literally? That's a big argument. I'm not the first one to bring up the topic. But I think it's a legitimate approach to say there's no contradiction between science and the Torah, where there's certain stories, as Ibn Ezra explains, when the story itself doesn't make sense logically to take it historically or take it literally, then it's permitted to take it metaphorically or allegorically, anyway, any fancy word you want to use there. Again, there's no question to the fact that Torah is from God and the story is given to us by God. The underlying question is in Parshanut, in interpretation, when I study the story, why did God give me the story? What I want to claim is that we don't keep Shabbat because God created in 7 days. God gave us the story of Shabbat. God gave us the story of creation so that we'll keep Shabbat properly. To appreciate why we keep Shabbat, God gave us the creation story. And I want to talk about that story and see how it explains so many things about Shabbat and our understanding of what's our relationship with God. I want to talk about now what I call format. And the first story in Chumash is a unit. I'll start with the first 6 days of creation because they follow a pattern. And first I want to point out there's a very basic format to the story of creation. Every day begins and ends the same way. What's my claim? I'll start with day two. Every day begins with what phrase? Vayomer Elokim. If you have a Tanakh Koran with you, if you open up your own Tanakh, you can see this. It's like obviously when you look at the Parshiyot, every day begins with the same phrase, Vayomer Elokim. Day three, Vayomer Elokim Yikavo Amayim. Day four, where's day four up there? Vayomer Elokim Yimorot. Day five, day six. Every day begins with the exact same phrase. We'll talk about day one in a minute. And every day ends with the exact same phrase. Vayer Vayboker Yom Blank. Yom Echad, Vayer Vayboker Yom Sheni. We call that format. You can't miss that format. Now, I want to suggest that day one also begins with Vayomer Elokim for a very simple reason. Day one ends with the same format as the 6 days of creation, because every day ends with Vayer Vayboker Yom Blank. But in Pasuk Gimel, I have the same phrase, Vayomer Elokim. So if Pasuk Gimel starts with Vayomer Elokim, just like all the other days, then the obvious conclusion would be that day one begins with Pasuk Gimel, and that makes day verses one and two an introduction, which makes perfect sense, because what's the introduction saying? Breshit bara Elokim et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz. That's introducing the story of creation that's going to progress, which ends with Vayichul hashamayim ve'aretz. It was the opening two lines is the introduction. Day seven is the conclusion, Vayichul hashamayim ve'aretz. And the story of creation itself begins with Pasuk Gimel with Vayomer Elokim. So again, number one, every day has the same format, Vayomer Elokim, followed and ends with Vayer Vayboker. What's most important, what follows every Vayomer Elokim? I guess if this was a longer class, I'd have everyone look into it and check it out and have a whole discussion, but we'll go right to the conclusion. Every Vayomer Elokim is followed by a command. Let me just demonstrate this. Every Vayomer Elokim is always followed by an imperative, a command. Vayomer Elokim Yior, let there be light. Day two, Vayomer Elokim Yihi Rakia, let there be a Rakia within the water. Day three, Vayomer Elokim Yikavu Hamayim. Every day, God is speaking, and God's making a command. Now, how that command happens, we'll talk about. But every day begins with an imperative. Something must be. Some are more active, some are more passive, but every day is a command. Day four, Vayomer Elokim Yihi Ma'orot Berki Hashamayim. Day five, Yishutzu Hamayim Sheretz Nefesh Chaya. Vayomer Elokim Day six, Totzi Haaretz Nefesh Chaya. So what's consistent in that pattern is that every day begins with a command. And what's going to follow every command? An execution. The first day is simple. But God says Yehi Or. What's the execution? Vayehi Or. Day two, God says Yireki Betoch Hamayim Yibnadu Ben Mayim LeMayim. What happens? Vayaselim Et Arakia. God makes a command, and the command is fulfilled. God said so, and it happens. How it happens? Chumash uses different verbs. Sometimes Vayehi, it just came about. Sometimes there's Asiya, like Vayaselukim Et Arakia. We'll see different examples of that. But whatever happens, every day begins with the exact same pattern. There's a command followed by an execution. And it's a format that you can't miss. Let's just take day five, for example. V'yimer Elokim, Yishirtzu amayim sheretz nefesh chaya, vof yofeif al eretz apnei roki ha-shamayim, command. And what's the execution? V'yivra Elokim et tatanim ha-gdolim et kod nefesh chaya. Here we have another verb of bria. Sometimes it's asiya, sometimes it's bria, sometimes it's vayhi. But the pattern is obvious. God makes a command and he executes the command. When you were davening this morning, you probably quoted a pasuk, I think, from Tidlim Lamed Gimel. For sure it's in I think it's around Tzadikim. But remember, Hu Amar V'yehi, Hu Tzeva V'yamod? I think we quote it in Yichavod, if I'm not mistaken. I'm sure you remember saying that in Psukei Zimra. Hu Amar V'yehi. God said, and it came about. Isn't that exactly a commentary on Perek Aleph and Breshit? Hu Amar, God said, Vayehi, and it came about. Vayomer li mihi or, vayehi or. Hu Tziva v'nivro. That's day five. Hu Tziva. Vayomer li kim yisrtu amayim, vayivro alokim et hatanim. Hu Amar, hu Tziva v'nivro. That's a comment on creation, on the story of creation. Now, what follows almost every act of creation and execution is an evaluation. For example, day one, God says, Yehi Or Vayehi Or. And then we have an evaluation, Vayar Limet Or Kitov. That's classic, isn't it? I'm skipping day two on purpose because for some reason, day two doesn't have an evaluation. It doesn't say it was bad, it just doesn't say anything. On day three, God says, let the waters gather together. I'm sorry, day three, let the waters together in Sidi Abasha. And then he calls Yabasha Aretz, and God says, Vayar Lehim Kitov. Every act of creation is always going to be followed by an evaluation. Day four, for example. God says, let there be Morot Rokei HaShamayim. And what happens? Vayas Elokim Mishnei Morot HaGdolim. The big light, the best small light, he puts them in the thing. And then it ends with Vayar Elokim Kitov. So again, what's the pattern? Every day, command, execution, evaluation, with the exception of day two. Now, in addition to that, that's common to every day of creation. In addition to that, there's always something extra. On day one, God gives out a name. On day two, he gives out names. On day three, he gives out names. On the first 3 days of creation, God gives out names. He calls the Or Yom and the darkness night. Day two, he gives a name for the Shamayim. Day three, he calls the Amim, he calls Aretz. He's giving, on days one, two, and three, God gives out names. On days four, five, and six, he's giving out jobs because he puts the sun and the moon in charge of the heavens. On day six, he gives not just a job, he gives them raising families, pruru. He tells the fish and the fowl to multiply. On day six, he gives a similar job. We'll see. He'll give a job later to man. So if I want to summarize, every day of creation has this format where there's a command, execution, evaluation, plus an add-on. And creation develops day by day. But on every day, something happens that didn't exist before. In the beginning, there was nothing. There was tohu vavohu, whatever that means. Or just chaos, I guess. By the time the 6 days are over, we have what we call nature. And God stops creating in a sense there's nothing new happening. We'll take a caveat on that. But basically, there are no more acts of creation after 6 days. God finishes his creation. The 6 days of creation are over, we have what we call nature. Now, nature is still dynamic and things continue to develop, but the laws of nature are set after 6 days. And then God rests on the seventh day. Now, if I ask myself, what's happening day by day? There's a very interesting pattern happening. God on day one makes light. That's simple. And he gives out names. Day two, God makes the rakia. Now, what's the rakia? The Rukia is basically what we call, I guess, called the sky or the firmament, whatever that means. But it seems like in the story of creation, the water was always around. God never tells us what day he made water. Water just seems to be there. but it was all over the place. And what did God do on day two? He took the water and divided it. He put some water up there and some water down here. He divided. And the division between what's up there, the water up there, and water down here is the rakia. What's he called the water up there? Well, up there in Hebrew, sham. So there's mayim up there. So sham mayim, up there is the water. That's, he's called that shamayim. And the water down below we call the amim. And that's where shamayim comes from. But the main thing that God makes, he actually doesn't make something too much new. He just divides them between up and he just organizes them. But still, it's an act of creation. It's something we perceive. We perceive a rakia. Now, on day three, he moves some water away, and then we get the Yabasha, and he gives it a name. He calls it Aretz. On day four, he makes the sun and the moon and the stars. Now, there's a famous question, which one of the reasons that it's easy to prove that you can't take this story literally, because God makes day and night on day one, but there's no sun and moon until day four. So this joke I like to say is as follows. On day four, God makes the Maor Gadol and the Maor Katan. He makes the big light, the big luminary and the small luminary. Notice he doesn't call them sun and moon. He doesn't say Shemesh and Yerech. He calls them Maor Gadol and Maor Katan. And he gives them jobs. What's the jobs? God says as follows. Et amot, let me make this bigger. He says, the Maor Gadol, the Memshela Tayom, he puts the sun, or the Maor Gadol, what we call the sun, in charge of the day, and the Maor Katan, what we call the moon, in charge of the night and the stars. What's my question? Wouldn't it make more sense for God to give us the sun during the night when it's dark out, when we could use him? Why waste the sun for daytime? Now, it sounds like Rabbi Jay's already laughing because he learned physics. Because we know from physics class that the reason that there's day is because of the sun. But it doesn't say that here, does it? There's already day and night since day one, by Erev Boker Yom Echad, and there's already Choshech and Or and Yom and Laila, and we don't have a sun and moon until day four. Now, one time, actually recently, I got up early in the morning, and I noticed there's light out before the sun rises, isn't there? So don't tell me, if I'm just landing on Earth and I'm observing nature, don't tell me that light is because of the sun. It can't be. Because there's daylight before the sun comes up. Now, the sun's in charge. The sun comes to work every day a half hour late, 45 minutes late. But he's consistent. Now, the sun is in charge of the day. He leaves the office about a half hour early. But the sun is always out there during the day. He's in charge of the day. But who says the daylight is because of the sun? We know that from physics. But for some reason, God puts the sun in charge of the day and the moon at night. Of course, the moon can't decide how big he wants to be. That's a different story. There's a beautiful midrash on that. What I want to point out, though, is what you can't miss is the connection between day one and day four. That should be obvious. Day one and day four are talking to each other. That's why they're lined up with each other here. Because he or day one, and Elohim says on day four, he ma'orot. Soon we'll talk about the name Elohim in a minute, like why that's the name for God in the story. But day one and day four are connected to each other. In some form or other, for sure. For sure, thematically connected in language, in topic, for sure. That might be by chance. When you look at day two, you can't miss the pattern. Because what happens on day two? On day two, God made the rakia that divided between the shamayim and the amim. What does God make on day five? On day five, God says, Yishurtzu amayim sheretz nefesh v'chaya, v'of yofev al haaretz al pnei rakia shamayim. On day five, what God makes on day five matches day two. Because on day two, God made the rakia, the divided between the shamayim and the amim. And sure enough, on day five, God populates the shamayim and the amim. But what's missing on day five, is anything living on land. So the animals that populate the sky and the sea, basically the fish and the fowl, match day two because on day two, God made the rakia, the divided between the shamayim and the amim. And of course, on day three, God makes land. And what does God make on day six? He makes the land animals. So once you see that, anyone who's seen this before, I'm sure most of you recognize this before, you can't miss the Chumash is using format to teach you something. Now, it doesn't spill the beans, but when you study the story, and that's my whole point, but Chumash is a book to study, not just read, you can't miss that Chumash is shouting day one matches day four, day two matches day five, and day three matches day six. The rabbis say this in a beautiful midrash, that every day of creation has a partner, except for Shabbat, day seven. So Shabbat feels totally left out. Every day has a partner. Everyone's got a shidduch except for Shabbat. So, and Shabbat is left alone. Doesn't match anything. Therefore, what did God create? God created the Jewish people to be a match for Shabbat. I don't know if you ever heard that midrash before, but that's the idea behind it. That just like every day of creation has a partner, Shabbat's partner is going to be later Am Yisrael. And don't be surprised that our reminder that God chose us to be his people will be Brit Milah on day eight. And that's already the Mara was called Be'al HaTeva, we'll see. That's how seven and eight go very nicely together. Whenever we have seven followed by eight, there'll be something universal followed by something particular for the Jewish people. Now, that's nice and simple. And what's behind this, I think, is God's name Elohim. If I go back to nature, let's say I had no tradition. I'm a human being living on planet Earth. And I begin to observe nature. I notice there's day and there's night and there's stars. And I notice that there's growth. I notice there's life and there's death. I know there's animals and there's species. And there's things that fly and things that don't fly. And there's fish in the sea. And there's trees that grow. Some give fruit, some are shrubs. I notice all these different things. And the most logical conclusion is that each one is controlled by some power. There must be some power controlling all these things. It's not obvious they're all coming from one source, but rather there are many gods, small g. And that's what ancient man thought. There's a god in charge of rain. There's a sun god. Everyone had a sun god. There's got to be a moon god. The stars, that there's constellations, they're gods watching us at night. If you ever camp out in the total darkness and you watch the constellations at night, it's so spooky, but you can't miss the idea that every night it's pitch black and you see all these stars and there's different shapes to them. It looks like someone's watching you at night. And therefore, all this culture develops and all this mythology develops about these different powers and different gods. But there's got to be some god in charge of growth, fertility god. Her name will be Asherah later on. There'll be a female god. There'll be a god in charge of rain. His name will be Baal. There's a god in charge of grain. His name will be Dagon. Any mythology sees all these powers of nature as being different powers. And Rabbi Yehuda Levi, in his famous book, the Kuzari, in Mamar, in the fourth section, he explains beautifully as follows. He says, why is the name for one God plural? You would think if we believe in one God, his name should reflect the fact he's one God. Our name for one God is all the powers. An El is a power. An Eloha is a power, is a God, like Elohim Acharim, other gods. But when we take the word for many gods, Elohim, and conjugate it in the singular, that's how Chumash teaches us monotheism. By making a mistake in grammar and saying, instead of Vayomru Elohim, Vayomer Elohim, and using Elohim in the singular, even though it's a plural verb, that's how Chumash teaches us that what appears to be many gods is one God. That's a special usage of God, of Chumash, of the name Elohim. And how do we distinguish between the one God and other gods? By conjugating the singular or the plural. But we do, when we're talking about other gods, in modern day Hebrew, we say Elohim. When we talk about our God, we say Elohim. But of course, in Chumash, it's written the same way. The way Chumash distinguishes between them is by using singular and plural. And that's why, and that could be, according to Rabbi Yehuda Levi, that's how Chumash teaches us monotheism. In the very first line of Breshit Bara Elohim, instead of Baru, using the singular, that's how Chumash teaches us monotheism. Now we'll get to our topic, which is the most important one. What I told you is true, except for one little caveat. What I claimed was every day of creation has a singular act of creation. There's a command, execution, evaluation, plus an add-on. Day three is an exception. Let's take a careful look at day three. What happens on day three? Move that. Brush the whole thing over. On day three, we're going to find two acts of creation. Now, if you're familiar with Jewish custom, when weddings were permitted back in the pre-corona days, there used to be a idea to get married on Tuesday, on Yom Shlishi. Everyone, I'm sure you're familiar with that custom. What's the reason? It's called Tuesday, Yom Shlishi is special because it says twice Kitov. Remember Pamayim Kitov? Therefore, there's the skula, something special to get married on Tuesday. If you're a caterer, you can charge more for Tuesday wedding, even more for Valentine's Day. Now, look at day three. We have the same pattern, but it repeats itself twice. What happens on day three? The commandment is, let the water, let there be abasha, and it happens. And Elohim calls the abasha aretz, and the mikvamim calls the amim, and it's good. I have an act of creation, I have a command, execution, evaluation with the name. And then, in the same day, there's a second act of creation. God could have done it all in one mamar, but he does it in two. There's two singular acts of creation on day three. What's the second act of creation? Tatshei ha'aretz, v'yomer Elohim command. Tatshei ha'aretz tesh eisa mazriya se'eitz priyo sepri, the mino. God says, let there be vegetation and trees and fruit. And it happens. And v'totzei ha'aretz tesh, just like God commanded, it's executed. And there's an evaluation, v'yomer Elohim kitov, and that's day three. It's very simple, day three. But day three is unique. It has two acts of creation, even though it could be done in one. Now, there's a connection between aretz and vegetation, isn't there? So it makes sense they're on the same day. But again, why do I need two separate acts of creation? For today's show, I'll call that 3A and 3B. The first act of creation on day three is land, 3A. 3B is vegetation. But there's a quantum leap from 3A to 3B. And I hope that's clear. Even though 3A and 3B are connected, aretz is connected to vegetation, what's the quantum leap from 3A to 3B? Anyone want to suggest? You can use the chat if you want. Let me stop the share for a minute.
Domeim and Sameach.
Yeah. We're going from, I'll be mean, God makes death. Now, what's that mean? God makes life, because everything alive dies. You might have noticed that. But the whole concept of life, which is totally strange, even in Darwinism, you can have this Big Bang theory. No one knows how we go from elements to all of a sudden to life forms. Once you get the amino acids, you know, Darwinism can take over, or evolution can take over. But what's this movement all of a sudden that things are alive? That we have these, we have life. We have life and we have death. And you see Perek Aleph screaming that on day three. That's Desha Esed Mazriya Zera. That's the ability. Every living thing can reproduce itself before it dies. That's Esed Mazriya Zera, Esed Priyo Sepri. Now, there's an obvious difference between trees giving fruit and vegetation growing from the ground. But they're similar in their life forms, and it's the very first time we have a life form. And of course, ancient man relates that to some type of gods controlling all that. In fact, we differentiate between these two types of creation on day three by making a separate bracha for Berit Pri Eitz and Berit Pri Adama. If you ever learn Masechet Brachot, you might remember that Rabbi Yehuda says there's a third category of brachot called Barim Minei Deshaim. That's because exactly of what we just read. Rabbi Yehuda reads, Totzi Haaretz Deshe, I'm sorry, God says, Totzi Haaretz Deshe, Kama, Esev, Mazriya Zera, Eitz Pri. There's three categories. Deshe, Adama, and Eitz. And Chachamim, see, this is an introduction, followed by colon, and two types of Deshe, which are Borei Pri Adama and Borei Pri Eitz. But the bracha we make every day is based on this distinction. Now, so day three is special. Now, you can guess already, if day one is parallel to four, and three is and two to five, and three is to six, what's bound to happen on day six? There'll be two acts of creation. And sure enough, that's exactly what we find. Let's take a quick look at day six. First, God says what? Let's make land animals. V'yomer Elohim command. Etc. And then God makes, fulfills that command. That's 6a. And he evaluates. You follow what my point is? The reason why Tuesday, why Yomshli has two evaluations is because there's two acts of creation. That's just to tell you when to get married. There's a logical reason for Tuesday being Pamayim Kitov. There's also two evaluations on day six because there's two acts of creation on day six. What's the first thing God makes? He makes the animals, the land animals. What's the second thing God makes on day six? He makes man. Now, there's a clear difference between animals and man, because when God makes a command, all of a sudden, Chumash does the grammar correctly. All of a sudden, Elohim is plural for some reason. So the rabbis say, Naseh, God's consulting with his board, with his board members, with the celestial bodies, you know, before, so there wouldn't be, Rashi explains, so there shouldn't be jealousy between God's creations. But when God makes man, everything's changing. There's his command, but God uses the plural and sort of consults with the rest of his creation about making man. And man is made b'tzelem Elokim. That's something special, whatever that means. And man has a job to do. He's in charge of everything created under the sun. The sun and the moon are in charge of everything in the sky. Man is in charge of everything on the ground. Okay. And then we have the verb bria again. God makes Adam b'tzamo, b'tzelem Elokim. And he gives him a blessing, a pool of root, just like the fish and fowl got. That's part with nature. But also, he puts them in charge. And then man gets a diet. And man can eat Bari Pri Ha'etz and Bari Pri Adama. And animals only eat Bari Pri Adama. In case you never noticed that, people usually don't notice that in creation, that only man eats from the tree and the animals only graze. And just as an aside, that's telling you that chapter one creation knows about chapter two, or chapter knows about chapter one, because there's no logic for Adam being called Adam until we have chapter two. Remember, when God makes Adam, Afar min Adama, I call him Adam. But there's no logical reason why man's called Adam in Perek Aleph, unless you know Perek Bet. And man eating, only man eating from a tree, and animals eating from vegetation, gets man in trouble in Gan Eden. So again, without going into the differences between these two stories of creation, they're aware of one another, but in a very subtle way, they're communicating with one another. But let's get to our topic. And this is my key point. If the parallel is correct, that every day is parallel, 1, 4, 2, 5, 3, 6, and we have 3A and 3B, 3A and 3B has to be parallel to 6A and 6B. Agreed? And you can't miss the parallel, because on 3B, God makes vegetation. He makes vegetation and fruit. And on 6B, he makes man who's able to eat from the fruit of the tree. And only the animals get the vegetation. But what I want to claim is the parallel of the jump from 3A to 3B is the key point that Chumash is making. What I want to claim is, just like I'm jumping from 3A to 3B, even though there's a logical connection, but there's two separate acts of creation, there must be a quantum leap from 6A to 6B. And just like there's a quantum leap from domain to tzomeach, from inanimate objects, from just elements to life forms, there's a quantum leap from animals to humans. And even though the jump from 3A to 3B is obvious, to an outside observer, the jump from 6A to 6B is not so obvious. Meaning, I could view man as part of the animal kingdom. Claiming that man is a totally separate act of creation and not part of the animal kingdom, that's a fundamental statement. And that, in my opinion, that's where religion begins. Why? Ask any Darwinist or any evolutionist, he'll tell you that man is like a super duper ape. And give monkeys a couple million years and they'll be making planes and not believing in God and things like that. They'll be really advanced. Just give animals more time and they'll develop like humans are. We're just ahead of the game a little bit. What Chumash is saying is there's a qualitative difference between man and animal. And there's a name for that qualitative difference. It's called Tzelem Elokim. And now I want to go to my other slide. I'll give you the way the Rambam understands this. He doesn't write it this way. I'm just giving a summary using mathematical symbols. I'll highlight this over here. The Rambam pretty much defines what's Tzelem Elokim. What does it mean that God made man in his image? He says as follows. There's no doubt that humans are similar to animals. Go to any museum of natural history, ask any student, write a composition. How are humans similar to animals? Boy, you can easily fill up a 3-page composition. There's so many similarities between humans and animals, I don't have to explain. Ask someone to explain what's the difference between human and animals. You can have a great discussion as well, but it's hard to pinpoint because animals talk, humans talk. Maybe animals speak Lashon Hara also. Animals are do things, we eat, they eat. There's tons of similarities, there's tons of differences. Is there one definition for the difference between man and animal? Is it wisdom? Again, that's a class in philosophy. What the Rambam claims, that's the deeper meaning of Tzelem Elokim. And he says, he's not defining what that difference is. He's saying, what is Tzelem Elokim? Whatever the difference is between man and animal, that's a Tzelem Elokim. Assuming there's a difference. Let's take the sum total of man, subtract that the sum total of animal, and what you get is Tzelem Elokim. I have the Rambam here, let's just read a little bit. He says the word Tzelem doesn't mean a shape because that's Dmut. He goes into the words. By the way, this is the opening section of the Rambam in Mori Nevuchim. Mori Nevuchim is a commentary on Chumash, and he begins his commentary on Chumash with defining what's the meaning of Tzelem Elokim. The Rambam understood that's the main point the Chumash is making in the beginning. And he says that it's describing what's the nature of man. He says, Rotzal Amar, Alinana Sherboni Tatsema Dabar Vu Mashu, that's the essence of man, that's the truth of man. And Hu Asher Bavroti Hasaganoshit. What the Rambam calls Hasaganoshit, I'll call creativity, or like the thinking mind. He says, man is different than animal. And that's what makes it, and that's why it's called Tzelem Elokim. Mashen Kem Beshar Dabar Min HaNimtzot Mitachat Gal Ke'orech. There's nothing similar to man in all of God's creation. There's a qualitative difference between man and animal, and that's he calls hasagas sichlit, I'll call it creativity. Meaning, how is man different than animal? He does things. He eats, again, he's very similar to animal, but what's different? Man is creative. Man has the ability to be creative. I joke around and say, man has the ability to believe that there's no God, which is only, I don't think, any other animal is so advanced to come up with such a theory that thinks that God doesn't exist. I'm joking, I want you to catch on. But man is super creative. He's so creative that sometimes he loses sight of the fact that there's a God who gave him that creative ability. What Chumash is telling you is man obviously recognizes he's different than animal. He has maybe some type of superpower more than animal has. And God gave man the ability to be creative. The question is, what do you do with your creativity? Do you realize that that's a gift from God and you use your creativity constructively to do good? Now, how to know what to do good? I need already, that's the rest of the book. What's good and what's bad and how do I know what's good and bad? And what happens if you do good or bad? But man's ability to be creative, that's the Tzelem Elokim. What you do with that creativity, that's where religion begins. The recognition that God gave you the ability to be creative. Now, you see something here very much connected to Shabbat in a minute, because what's forbidden on Shabbat? It's creativity that's forbidden, isn't it? That's called Melechet Machshevet. It's thinking about doing something and then doing it. That's exactly the pattern of creation. Remember who Amar, God commands and executes? Let's plan something. Let's think of doing something that wasn't there before, and then let's do it. Everything created begins with sitting back and thinking, oh, I have an idea. I have an idea. Let's try to do it. That act, which the rabbis call Melechet Machshevet, is the essence of creation. And God finishes creation. The last thing that God makes in creation will be man. And he puts man in charge of that creation. And that's why I told the title from creation to civilization. Because nature is over, but it's dynamic. But what causes things to change? Man's in charge now. Now, what did God do? God created and then rested. And you rest to evaluate what you've done. That's the big question. Are there 6 days of creation or seven? It depends whether resting and evaluating and looking back at what you've done is part of creation. Again, another philosophical discussion. But the key point is man's ability to be creative is a gift from God. Now, watch how this explains something so beautiful about what we do on Shabbat or what we can't do on Shabbat. My claim is what's forbidden on Shabbat, I need to remember not only that God created, but that God made man with creativity. And he has to use that creativity properly in the service of God. Now, if I ask myself, how are humans different than animals? If I have an outside observer looking, give me examples how humans are different than animals. Don't tell me speech because animals communicate. We might not understand them, but they talk to each other. But animals don't write down their thoughts and pass it down. They might do it in DNA, but the idea of writing something, taking your thoughts, writing them down in a way that a future generation can understand them, that's something I'm pretty sure only humans do and animals don't do. But if I go back to history of civilization, most people begin study of civilization about 10,000 years ago with the domestication of wheat and animals. Remember, there's a whole thing of Noah Harari has a whole thing that it's not that man domesticated wheat. He claims that wheat domesticated man, if you know his theory. It's sort of cute. But there's no doubt that domestication of wheat is unique to humans. No animal in his right mind is going to plant grain, right? Wait a couple months for it to grow, harvest the grain, let it till he harvests it, finally get those little kernels out, then grind them up, add some water, mix them up, put them in an oven, and make bread. Just eat the grain. Every other living thing is a hunter-gatherer. Just eat what's out there. The idea of domesticating wheat and making bread and making that your staple and getting hooked on it. Now, an animal, if we make a challah, an animal's going to eat it. But no animal in the right mind is going to do anything of planting and harvesting and baking. Now, another obvious, it's the same thing with domesticating other animals. Cattle, sheep and cows, that's right. Cowboys and shepherds, basically. Making a business out of animals. Not just eating them, but making more animals. Using their milk, using their skins, using their hides. And growing animals, the whole idea of cattle and sheep. Those are the most ancient professions for ever since kind and heaven, isn't it? The farmer and the shepherd. And that's where civilization begins about 10,000 years ago with the domestication of wheat and with domestication of animals and making a business out of them. Now, another clear difference between humans and animals is clothing. There's no other living thing that needs clothing. Naturally, again, we might make clothes for our dogs or for our pets, but they don't need that clothing. Humans need clothing. We shed our fur for some crazy reason and we make clothes. Is that better or worse? You can argue, but only humans make clothing. And it's a whole complicated process of making clothing. We write, only humans, again, ants build ant farms, but they don't try to outdo their neighbors and make new model ant farms every year, every 2-3 years. And they're not, it's in their DNA, the ant farm. It's not a creative thought of let's make a better ant farm this year. It might happen slowly over millions of thousands of years or millions of years, but not a new model every year. And also living in making houses, I'll call it industry, basically utilizing fire, melting down core metals and then forging them into tools. Again, animals make maybe simple tools, but the idea of forging tools, making airplanes, making machines, we don't see animals doing that. I don't think they'll be doing it for the next couple of million years either. I don't think we're just ahead of it. It's a totally different type of creativity, which is unique to humans. Now, if I take all those things, if you just didn't catch on, we just, by the way, in the Maharal, he says this in a nutshell, when he talks about in Tiferet Yisrael, what's the idea of Tzelem Elokim? He says something similar to the Rambam. He says, Ki mashu adam hu banai, the fact that man is a builder, Nagar, a carpenter, Osem b'lochot afiya, and Bishul, he cooks and bakes. Chiyotze b'zeh, u'matkin d'begarim, he makes clothing. Okay, these are all things that need a nefesh sichlit. What the Rambam called hasagah sichlit, he calls nefesh sichlit. That's his definition for Tzelem Elokim as well. He says there's a qualitative difference between man and animal, and that's your Tzelem Elokim. Now, if you look carefully, we basically just explained all the melachot of Shabbat, didn't we? If you remember, what's the melachot of Shabbat? Sidura depat, the whole process of making bread, from planting to harvesting, to winnowing, whatever they do, and then grinding it, and then finally making dough and cooking it. That's unique to humans. Animals don't do that. The whole process of making clothing, unique to humans. From the time you shear your sheep until you whatever you do to make the wool, and to spin it, and to sew, and to do the whole arigah stuff, the whole process of writing, from the time you make the hides to you straighten them out, to you write on them, and writing letters on them, and the idea of building and construction, not to mention fire, right? And then the last thing, hutzah, I call that moving inventory. It has to do with making money out of nothing or from trading goods, but that's again the melacha of hutzah. That's always an exception. I think there's something really creative about that, but that's a class in economy. Now, so my claim is, what are the melachot of Shabbat, basically? Once a week, I need to remember that God created me with creativity. And I stop all creativity to remember not only that there is a creator, but there's a creator who gave me the ability to be creative. I need to remember that it's a gift from God, not just thank him for it, but remember how to use it properly. And that's, in my opinion, that's reason enough for God to give us the story of creation. I don't care how God actually created everything, but now that creation has these laws of nature and God made all this, how does man fit into nature? Man needs to know he's different than animal. And that's extremely important for man to recognize that. And therefore, that's going to be something that he has to remember every day of his life. I don't have time now, but we can use that also to explain almost everything we do in the Mishkan. What are the sacrifices that we bring? All the sacrifices that we bring are from the things that are manner different than animals. What animals are sacrifices? The domesticated animals, cattle and sheep. We bring flour, don't we? Processed flour or a mincha. We don't bring grain. We process the grain, and we bring flour. Sometimes we bake it even. We make it matzot. We make it different types of menachot. We make a big deal about clothing in the Mishkan, don't we? All I did big day kuna. In the Aron, we have just making the kelim themselves. The vessels are all forged metal, but the written contract is at the center. Right? The luchot habrit, the written word of God, in the middle of the sanctuary, and we have a table. We show off our bread. We bring wine, don't we? Wine is another type of processed food. No animal is going to take good grapes, squeeze them, let them sit in a pot and get ruined or fermented, and charge you a fortune for it. You know, and charge you just because it's sat for a couple hundred years, a couple decades. No animal in the right mind is going to pay so much money for that. They'll just eat the grapes when they're fresh or save them for later. But these are all things, everything we do in the Mishkan, everything we bring to God, we're basically reminding God of our day-to-day life. It's clothing, it's light. Remember, it's making light, making and writing things down. Again, that's a whole different shir on the Mishkan. But again, the Mishkan and Shabbat are for sure connected, aren't they? That we all know. And in fact, what do we know? What can't you do on Shabbat? All the things needed to build the Mishkan. But that's exactly the same idea. And now, if you have your Chumash open, you'll see that in the whole commandment to build the Mishkan in Parsha Truma and Tetzaveh, there's a whole unit from chapter 25 to chapter 30, to chapter 31 in Sefer Shemot. Seven times God speaks to Moshe Rabbeinu, commanding the Mishkan. One big command in Truma Tetzaveh, and then six short commands in the beginning of Parsha Kitisa, in chapters 30 and 31. But we find seven different commands where God explains to Moshe Rabbeinu how the Mishkan, six about the Mishkan, and the seventh one is about Shabbat. Again, there's so many parallels between Shabbat and the Mishkan, but that's, again, I'm sure you probably heard that before. So let me summarize my key point I'm trying to make. My point is that whenever we're going to have the number seven in Tanakh, especially in Chumash, it's going to relate to the fact that what we call nature is a gift from God. God created civilization. God created nature, created man with the ability to be creative. God gave man the ability to develop civilization. God wants man to take, he put man in charge of civilization. He wants man to be good. But with the ability to be creative comes the ability to do good or bad. That's already a topic for chapter 2 in creation. And God's going to command, give God guidelines. So he'll teach us a lesson when man misuses his creativity and becomes corrupt, that brings the flood. Then God, after the flood, is going to say, I'm not going to destroy man again. I'm going to let him learn from his mistakes, be living in a world of tshuva, a world of tikkun. So man has the ability to do good or bad. Man has the ability to learn from his mistakes. And that's how you grow with God, grow with civilization. You do something, you make a mistake. You recognize your mistake. You're sorry for it, but you can learn from your mistakes. You can grow from them. The whole process of tshuva. But that idea that God gives us the story in creation of 7 days in order that we keep Shabbat, not just Shabbat, but anything that has to do with nature, to remember that there's a God who made nature. And God, man should not think he is a God, but rather he's a servant of God. He's like God. He's godly. But there's a purpose in his creation. We'll always have the number seven. Therefore, anything agricultural, anything relating to man's interaction with nature, where man might think there's other gods or many gods, and we need a reminder that there's one God who made the system we call nature, is going to have the number seven. So let's go back to what we talked about in the beginning of this year. So again, I'll leave alone creation, the story of the flood. That's a little complicated for now. But if I want to go back to the beginning of our source sheet, where do we find number seven? So again, Brit Mila, we talked about. In Pharaoh's dream of the seven cows in 7 years, no, 7 lean years, seven fat, that's for sure nature, isn't it? The whole process of grain, it goes back to seven. I think Pharaoh's dream, Yaakov working for Rachel, is going to be the background for Pharaoh's dream, but that's a Shir in Sefer Bereshit. Brit Milah, of course, relates to 7 and 8. But in Sefer Shmot, when I have the Shosh Regalim in Chag HaMatzot, but as soon as we see the commandment of Chag HaMatzot, it's always in the Aviv. God says, Shmor Chodesh Aviv, Asita Pasach Hashem Elokecha. HaChodesh Zeh L'Rosh Chodeshim, Hayom Atem Yisim B'Chodesh Aviv. Aviv is the beginning of the grain harvest. And therefore, why do we have a seven-day holiday in the beginning of the grain harvest? Remember, in the land of Israel, there's only one grain harvest a year. It begins, we mentioned this last week, it begins in mid-April, ends in mid-June. It's about 2 months, or basically the 7 weeks of Sefirot HaOmer. What God wants you to remember is that when I begin my grain harvest, I need to remember that the grain harvest is a gift from God. And even though I'm doing it myself, the system through which man can harvest grain, God gave man that ability. Therefore, if I'm going to have a Chag HaMatzot in the Aviv, and I'm going to relate this to my grain harvest, we'll talk about this next week, the lead to the holiday of Shavuot, and if I'm going to collect my harvest every year for about 2 months or 7 weeks, and I need that food to last the entire year because that's my staple, and therefore that grain harvest is critical, ancient man would want to make sure his grain harvest is successful. It'll pray to the grain god or pray to the fertility god, to the rain god. Whatever he needs for that grain to grow, God says, no, don't follow them. There's one God who gave you that ability to grow grain. He's in charge of the grain, not based on your prayers, but based on your deeds. And what do you do with your grain? Once you have your grain, what do you do with your grain harvest? And that's the laws of Lechet Shichan and Peah. That's the law of Omer later on, V'shachat Omer Basadeh, Lechet Shichan Peah, which we'll see all this next week. God is going to give you grain based on what you do with your grain. If you're going to learn the lesson of the desert, when God provided you with food when you didn't have, you're about to harvest your grain. Every day of the grain harvest, you're thinking about not just the Omer and God providing for you, but also the theme of seven and the God who made nature and gave you the ability to be a farmer. And therefore, I'm going to count weeks. It's not just another way to remember 50 days or 49 days. And I'm going to celebrate a holiday called weeks. The concept of a week is what we're celebrating. And Chumash begins its entire interaction with man. God's revelation to man, giving us the Torah, begins with the concept of seven in a week, because it's the beginning of a whole relationship with God, the recognition that you're different than an animal, and there's something godly about you. But you aren't a god, but you're godly. What you do with your godliness, with your creativity, that's where religion begins. And that's why anything we'll have with nature will be the number seven. The Shalosh Regalim, which we'll see later on in next week in Vayikra, Chav Gimel, Halis and Amor, are all going to relate to cycles of nature. It can be the rainy season in Tishrei, it can be the green season or the fruit harvest later in the year. They all relate to seven, be it 7 days, 7 weeks, seventh month, etc. And it'll be obvious in Devarim chapter 16, we'll see the number seven will be the big star. Everything will relate to the number seven. Remember, Shiva Shavuot Tispor Lach. Why? Because there's such a danger that living with nature is going to lead man away from God. Man has to remember there's a God who created him, who gave him that ability. Therefore, Chumash is going to use the number seven anytime it has to do with recognizing God behind nature. And don't be surprised, remember, you find God through historical events or through nature. I can take nature. Nature can hide God, or study nature can lead me to finding God. Don't be surprised that the first of our forefathers in Bereshit, who God doesn't talk to, only through dreams, but finds God in everything he's doing, don't be surprised that the number seven will be critical in his life, and with Yosef and his dreams and you know, what's going on in Egypt, where they put, then explain all the laws of Matzah later on, and nature and how we view nature. Again, so let me, our time is up for today, but I want to dedicate today's shir to the story of creation, the number seven. It's not just one story in Chumash, it's the opening story of Chumash. It's the key theme of Shabbat. It's a key theme. It's the story that begins a relationship with God. And therefore, when I study Chumash and I try to understand why is God beginning with the story of the seven-day week, and then I'm faced with science that tells me a totally different story, that's not a problem at all. The topic of Chumash isn't how God did it. How God did it, that's God's problem. We know that he did it. How he did it, that's ask a scientist. Why he made man? And what does his creation mean to man? And how does man understand his unique ability to be creative? And how does man perceive nature that surrounds him? And what does he do with that ability? to be in charge of nature, and using that ability to do good and be godly, that'll be the rest of Chumash. And therefore, the number 7 will be key. And next week, we're going to use that to explain why counting Sefirah is going to be so important, why not counting weeks, why we call the holiday weeks, and how that's going to explain not just the holidays and the more, also all the laws in Sefer Devarim. Okay? I'll take, if you have any minute for a question or two, let me stop the share.
But if you want to put questions, I'll thank you in the interim. Even if one wants to speak their question, that's fine. If you don't want to type it, stay on for a minute. Thank you. Thank you again. This evening, of course, 8:30, Mark Shapiro on the Escape of the Mir Yeshiva to Shanghai. Tomorrow, we're starting 2 new shiurim. Marty Laksh, and those in Toronto know him quite well, professor for many years here, now been living in Israel. 4-week series on Parshanut. Tomorrow on Rashi. Every week, we'll do a different Parshan. And evening, Miriam Kruka, the director of Jewish Studies at Ramaz, will be giving a talk on the prophet and the priest. So that's tomorrow night, 8:30. And follow your emails. It's a pleasure to learn with everybody. Be healthy, be well. And thank you again, Rabbi Liebtag. And if anybody has any questions, Vakasha.
Just one thing. I noticed there's a question about bees making honey and animals actually answer more industrious than humans are. But that's usually in their DNA. A beehive, he builds a beehive, but he doesn't make a new beehive every year and trying to outdo the beehive and work. There's certain things in animals in their DNA that they build things, but it's not the same type of creativity that humans have. Again, it could be only a qualitative difference. I'm claiming it's a quantitative difference. I'm purposely dodging the question how to define it, because Chumash defines it, that's Tzelem Elokim. So maybe you'll find some definition for it. I'm saying that there's a difference between humans making airplanes and skyscrapers and bees making honey and birds making nests. It's not just a quantitative difference. It's only a matter of a couple million years and they'll catch up with us. I think it's a qualitative difference between man and animal. Again, you can argue that point. I think there's logic to that point, and I just see that all the laws of Shabbat exactly fit into the difference between man and animal. Like the difference between man and animal are exactly all the things we don't do on Shabbat and all the things that we do in the Mishkan.
Are music and art part of those, or non-utilitarian crafts, artistic endeavors, are those part of?
I see that in a member of the seventh generation of Lemech. There's these three sons, Tuval,
Kayan, and
Yabal. Yeah, they're the masters of one's music, one's thing. Those are all unique human things. Now, birds.
Are they reflected in Mishkan?
Birds, I think, what do you call it? They make beautiful music. You know, you have animals singing and making beautiful sounds, but I don't think they compose concerts like Mozart did. I don't think
is in the Mishkan. I don't know if you heard that right, Blake. You were asking if it's in the Mishkan. Of course, you know, music is an integral part of the Mishkan. And interestingly, it's a rabbinic prohibition on Shabbat. It's not a biblical prohibition.
You've become a former rabbi now, huh?
Kind of interesting. I'm just thinking about that. Because it was added, the Levim, the Shir Shel Levim. Anyway.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. I think we'll thank you very much and have a nice day and be well. And we'll hope to see you over the course of the week.
A nice proof to that. If the word neshama, which is unique to man, is the only time in Tanakh and Tehillim you have, it's the last line of Tehillim. It's the only time you have the word neshama. Remember calling shema to lay hallelujah. But that's all about musical instruments and percussion instruments praising God. B'kinor, b'nofel, it's our ability to use music to praise God. It's also something unique to humans. And that question, Kol Neshama, is that every breath or every neshama? That's a great machloket of Parshanim, what the word neshama there means. Okay, so we'll stop here, and thank you again very much. And
thank you
next week.
Okay.